Okay, Abby, if you were just to ask the person on the street, did Aristotle think the same way we did? Or maybe even go back further, did Hammurabi, or did Pharaoh Tutmosis, did he actually, when they thought about things, did they think the same way we did? What do you think most people would say?
Probably not.
So, like, their brains worked differently?
I mean, yeah. I mean, when we see their representations of their world through their artwork, it just looks so different than what we make as representations of the world.
Right.
So I think we think about them as significantly different and removed from us.
Yeah. Okay, so this has been a big question in scholarship because things are so different, and ancient scholars or people who study, you know, Egypt, Mesopotamia, even Greece and Rome, they all point to how different these worlds are, and we got to be very careful not to treat them as if they were the same people as us, living, you know, eating cheeseburgers and having cell phones in their pockets. And so there's some truth to this. I mean, the question is, how far down does that go? Like, because if you say, let's just say Hammurabi, just say he literally actually did not think the same way we did, then why would we believe that we could read his writing and understand it? He might mean something different by every single word than what we mean today, and therefore everything is off limits to us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the deep problem of this general question of, do ancient folks think like we do? It's generally believed, the theory is that the Axial Age came about 500 years before Jesus, where all of a sudden there's this question, why in China and India and Greece and Rome and everywhere seems to wake up and like become hip to the world in a different way and talk about the world in a different way. So some people think there's something special that happened in that period. And then the question is, well, what was going on before that? What were people like before that? But I come back to this same question of, if people didn't think the same way we did, and by that I mean, like, their brains just didn't work the same way, or their minds, you know, the brain is the physical part, the mind is what we call the non-physical part of our thinking mechanisms. If their minds work differently, then there is this question of, can we understand anything they ever said?
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people want to say, yes, we can read them and understand something about their world. And most biblical scholars would say, yes, we can read this and understand something about the world, but we need to contextualize everything and make sure we understand. So that's been a big question, mostly in biblical scholarship, because people think it really matters that we understand what the biblical authors thought and meant by what they said. But it's not just been in biblical studies. So there's been two famous, or infamous, maybe, depending on how you put them, scholars, Torleif Bowman and Johannes Petersen, who both basically said, no, they don't think like we do. They're different. And, you know, Bowman, and I think they're both right to some extent. I think they're both highlighting that they have a very different way of conceptualizing the world. But that doesn't mean that we don't have access to the way they conceptualize the world. So Bowman very famously wrote, you know, Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew mind couldn't think of an object and its action as separate from one another. So if you have somebody throws a rock, they can't separate out the rock as an object that could have been any rock. It's like, no, they threw that rock and that's it. That's the extent of their conceptual world. So if you say, like, well, you know, is it throwing a rock that's a problem? You know, if you're talking about a crime, could you throw something else? And they'd say, no, Joe threw that rock. That's the problem, right? They can't conceptualize outside of the particular action that happens. And Bowman would say it was the Greeks who came along and it could separate out the object from the verb, as it were, right? So there's something that makes a rock apart from any particular rock. There's rockiness, you know, or there's this quality called rockness that that when we talk about a rock or a pile of rocks, we all know what we're talking about apart from any particular pile we've seen. And so he kind of makes the argument that this is the Greek contribution, or this is the Greek turn of taking the object and separating it from the action. But the flip side of that is that the Hebrews can't do that. They physically, their brains cannot do that, right? And so you can imagine this caught a lot of heat in scholarship. And eventually there were some scholars who showed, it was based on a bunch of assumptions that, you know, so there were some assumptions like, if you don't see a word for something in a language, then they don't have a concept of that thing. And so that was kind of a controversial theory that was lasted for quite a long time in scholarship. But eventually people, I think, came around to the idea that, no, you can actually understand something and have a thick concept of something and not necessarily have a good word for it. Mm-hmm. And we see this in lots of areas of our lives today where, I mean, we could talk about all kinds of weird circumstances. I think of Brazilian Portuguese because they have this great word, saudade, which is that feeling of tension and love and longing that you feel when you're separated from something that you're supposed to be with. So when two spouses are separated from each other, you know, they're in different continents or in different cities or something, they would say to each other, I have saudade. I have this thing, right? Or I feel this thing. And well, we don't have a word for that in English. So does that mean that we don't have a concept of the tension and the longing and the desire to be together? It's like, well, no, it's that we just have not boiled it down to a single word. And so there's lots of things like this. So if you assume that you have to have vocabulary and to match ideas, then you can see why there are all these assumptions that get poured into when they look at the Bible. Well, they don't have a word for this, so they must not be thinking about it. So that's one of the issues that had to get dealt with. The other one is just that maybe they do talk about this stuff. They just talk about it in a different way than mm-hmm. we do. So there is this kind of what you call like a Greekophilia, right? Where the Greeks did everything correctly. They're the ones who finally liberated us from mythology and moved us into the world of abstract thought. And so if they aren't doing it the way the Greeks did it, then they're not doing it, is kind of the idea here. And we could say, well, no, they do have an idea of talking about, or they have a way of talking about abstract ideas, but they do it through story and narrative, story and poetry, and even legal material often expresses abstract ideas. But you have to be tuned in to the way they're doing it.
Right.
So maybe I'll come back to the question. Can we say that we have access to the way ancient people thought, even if they conceptualized the world differently than we did?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess then the question is, well, what do we have to do in order to understand the way they conceptualize
right.
the world? And what do you think most people would, like on the street, literally, if we pulled people aside and said, how can you understand what Moses or Aristotle, maybe pre-Aristotle, mm-hmm. What would you have to do in order to understand what they thought?
Pay close attention, read again and again and again, and be careful not to be careful to pay attention to your assumptions mm-hmm. that are continually getting in the way.
Yeah. That is so simple. It really is. And it's actually like in among spouses when you do marital counseling, it's like you're saying the exact same things. Can pay very close attention what they're saying, how they're saying it, the context. Don't assume, right? I mean, it's all the same thing. It's basically just caring for the other and trying to listen very carefully.
Hmm.
And I think it's fair to say there's a large chunk of European scholarship that dominated biblical studies
mm-hmm.
that, you know, there's a saying, I won't get it exactly right, but it's something like, you know, these German scholars looked down the deep well of history to try and analyze the real Jesus apart from the text, right? To get behind the text and see what the real Jesus was like. And when they stared down this deep well of history, all they really reported back was their own mirror image of themselves,
yeah,
you know,
reflection.
And the water at the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was really them bringing a bunch of assumptions about what Jesus should be and essentially using the biblical text to describe what they thought he should
mm-hmm.
have been,
mm-hmm.
which I think we all get caught red-handed doing this mm-hmm. At times. So yeah, the trick is to listen, think, don't say, well, they don't talk about this topic like metaphysics, therefore they're not interested in it. Say, the question has to change. if Hebrews were at all interested in metaphysical issues, how would they talk about them, right? How would they describe them? And of course, I think they are interested in describing metaphysics, but a lot of it comes down to the metaphysics of cleanliness, or the metaphysics around the temple, or the metaphysics around the presence of God, and less so the metaphysics of time, for instance, one that they're not as interested in exploring.
So when I've heard, when people are asking this question about whether or not ancient people think like we do, I've heard the analogy used to describe our mind versus the ancient mind as two rivers that are separate from one another and flowing in different directions, and they never cross. So we can't access the minds of ancient people because they're in a different river. How would you respond to that?
So in some way, I would want to affirm that, A, it's a really good analogy for getting people to think about, like, they really did think about the world differently.
Yeah.
And differently doesn't mean so differently that we can't understand it. It just means it's a very different approach to the world. And the other thing I would like to say is, look, if you're an Israelite or a Roman, let's forget about Israelites. If you're a Roman citizen going regularly as a part of your civic duty and paying taxes and offering animal sacrifices to the gods and maybe even to the emperor in some cases, that's going to shape the way you think about the world in a way that I will not be able to understand.
Totally.
I know what it's like to pay taxes, but that kind of activity, it sculpts my understanding of myself and the world, my relationship to the empire, my relationship to the state, my civic duties, in a way that cutting a check to the IRS does not. So I do want to say there is always going to be something that's off limits about how they understand the world, because I don't farm, you know, the central hill country of Israel. I don't depend on wait on the rains and depend on them. I don't go to the temple and pilgrimages. So yeah, they understood some things in ways that I don't. But I do think actually when you look at like the sacramental life that Jesus left us, he gave us things that give us access to the same kinds of ways of thinking about the world. So he didn't strip us out of that world. He said, here's a portable version of that you can take anywhere out into the world. So I want to say, yeah, there are these two rivers, but I don't want to say they're two separate rivers. Maybe I want to say, like, we're downstream from that river, right? So there's a cultural river in which they swim, and everything makes sense to them up there. And maybe it's a giant river with all kinds of, you know, crocodiles or whatever. And we're in the Mississippi or whatever, but all the water is connected somehow. And so again, going back to what you suggested is being very careful to check our assumptions at the door, being careful to listen again and again and make sure that we understand just the logic of what people are, why things are connected together for them. There is a problem of this in Mesopotamian literature where you have all of these omens and, you know, they're very rigorously logical people. Everything they write is rigorously logical. But then you run into especially omens and some medical text where it's just impossible to tell what they think is going on. And, this, you know, like that there's going to be an eclipse of the moon on the horizon at noon or something. Like, well, they would have known that was physically impossible. They tracked the moon very closely. They tracked all the stars very closely. So there are some things where you look at the ancient world and you go, yeah, I don't think we're ever going to get inside what they're thinking here. It's almost like you have to be standing over their shoulder and have them explain it to you very carefully. And then you might be able to go, oh, okay, that's what that means. But that's not what we have in the Bible. I mean, there are a few things where we're like, okay, I'm not quite sure what that's talking about. But most of it, the logic, the inner logic of the biblical text and the laws and the poetry, actually, you know, if paid careful attention to, you can at least figure out what they cared about, what they thought was going on, even if you can't figure out every single detail of what was going on in their mind.
The analogy seems to suggest that we can't have access to the other river, but maybe to turn it, it teaches us that in order to really understand what the biblical authors are thinking, we need to, more than just taking sips of their water, actually jump into the river and immerse oneself in their ways of thinking to understand the way that they thought.
Yeah, the more you can, as you read every word, think of like, okay, now they, you know, they're coming out of the Egyptian context where they thought the sun was swallowed up and dies every night and is reborn again and is a god, right? Okay, plague of darkness is now starting to make a lot more sense as to why God chose this against the Egyptians. Yeah, so just kind of you know, that's why we teach these things, is so that you can get into the river and play around and swim around and see how it works and feel the currents and feel the undertows and those kind of things. So, yeah, very good.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.